Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, the Markla Center for Applied Ethics, the Center for Science, Technology, and Society, and the High Tech Law Institute. My name is David DeCoss, Director of Campus Ethics Programs at the Ethics Center. We are proud to present tonight's program as a collaborative effort of our four organizations. To find out more about us, please visit our websites. We also hope you will join us for another collaborative program co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club and the Ethics Center on Thursday, February 24th, when leading education policy writer Dr. Diane Ravitch will discuss the paradox of education reform today here at Santa Clara. At this time, I invite you to look at the index cards that have been left at your seats. During our program, we will have time for your questions. We encourage you, the way we'll do that, is to have you write your questions on these index cards as members of our staff. And Monica and Melissa, if you could put your hands up, please. There's Melissa in the back. If you can see her back there, and I think Monica will be coming in. They'll be coming up and down rows. If you put your hand up with your card, they can come by and pick it up. They also have pencils if you need that to jot something down. Tonight's program is being videotaped by Fora TV, and a podcast will be available on the Markla Center's website. For this reason, we ask that you kindly turn off all of your cell phones. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Jane McConigal, world-renowned game designer and author of the new book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. Jane is a product of a Jesuit university education, having graduated from Fordham College. She also has a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and is the director of games research and development at the Institute for the Future, a nonprofit research group. She has created award-winning games in more than 30 countries, working with such partners as the International Olympics Committee and the World Bank Institute. She has also developed internal game workshops for Fortune 500 and Global 500 companies, including Nike, Disney, McDonald's, and Microsoft. A recipient of the Activism Award from SXSW Interactive and the Innovation Award from the International Game Developers Association, Jane presented at last year's TED conference. Her other recognitions include Business Week's Top 10 Innovators to Watch, MIT Technology Review's Top 35 Innovators Changing the World Through Technology, and Oprah's 2010 20 Most Inspiring Women in the World. Jane is the founder of Gameful, a secret headquarters for world-changing game developers, and currently serves on the advisory board for Games for Change and for the annual Serious Games Summit at the Game Developers Conference. She has taught game design and game theory at UC Berkeley and the San Francisco Art Institute, and her life goal is to see a game developer win a Nobel Peace Prize. Moderating tonight's program is Dr. Chad Raphael, Department Chair and Associate Professor of Communication here at Santa Clara University. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jane McConigal and Dr. Chad Raphael.
Thank you, David, and thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. So, Jane, you've written this really interesting book, which I got a chance to read this weekend, about the benefits of gameplay and about how we might cure some very big real-world problems by thinking about them as gamers and by addressing them directly through gameplay. Well, let's start with a deceptively simple question that you begin with in the book. What exactly is a game?
Yes, deceptively simple, but we have so many games now. We have video games, we've got computer games, we've got games for our cell phones, there's still card games, board games, sports. So what I wanted to do was to look at all the games that we have and come up with something that was really central to all of them. Because I think everyone, you know when you're playing a good game, it's not really what the mechanics are or what the structure is, it's how you feel. There's just something that happens when we come into a good game. So I was able to find in all of the writing that has been written about games what I think is really the best definition. It's that games are unnecessary obstacles that we volunteer to tackle. Because when you think about it, games are really hard work. You know, we have to save the world, or we have to save someone's life, or there's all these things that we have to sort, and you know, it's always like some big goal. And we decide of our own free will to spend our free time putting our motivation and our energy and our focus and our skills to solve these totally unnecessary, arbitrary problems.
And why do we do that? Why would we put ourselves through that?
Well, so in the book, I look a lot at research around psychology, cognitive science, biochemistry that tries to figure out sort of optimal states of being. So what is that natural set point that we try to get towards in daily life? A lot of us think that we want to be relaxed, or that games are a way of relaxing or escaping. But actually, if you look what's happening in our minds and bodies when we're playing games, it's actually a very stressed out situation. We get adrenaline, we have the attention centers of our minds are focused, and our sensory perception is sharpened. It's actually neurologically and physiologically identical to being under negative stress, when we're fearful or when we feel like somebody's demanding something from us. But because we have chosen to activate that stress, we experience it as motivating, as exciting, as rewarding. And so psychologists call that positive stress or eustress. And it turns out that what we most want from life is to be fully engaged in a state of eustress, sort of marshaling all of our resources to do something that feels important and that we feel like we have a chance to be successful at. And so when we go to play games, it's usually because we're bored, we want to be activated, or we're frustrated, so we want to do something that we can actually have a chance of really doing well. So it's really getting into that state of positive stress.
And then you mentioned that all games have a couple of characteristics. For example, they involve goals, goal-directed mm-hmm. activity. They're rule governed. Mm-hmm. There are rules that apply to everybody. They give us feedback mm-hmm. about how we're doing, and that we participate in them voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about different kinds of definitions of games and a play, a particularly influential one by the Dutch anthropologist Johan Huizinga, who wrote this incredibly influential book in game studies, Homo Ludens, Huizinga defined play as existing in its own magic circle, mm-hmm. Separate from the world. He saw play as, quote, a free activity standing quite consciously outside ordinary life as being not serious, but at the same time absorbing the player intensely and utterly. It is an activity connected with no material interest and no profit can be gained by it.
Mm-hmm.
How are your hopes for gameplay really quite different from that vision of play as separate from the world?
Yeah, well, actually, it's something. So I wrote about Huizinga's work a lot in my dissertation at Berkeley, and it's something he struggles with a lot in the book, because then he goes on to say that everything is play. Literature is play. Politics is play. War is play. Religion is play. He has a chapter about all of these things. And so his point was that we have this play spirit. We're never more alive than when we're playing. And that in the best circumstances, we bring this play spirit into spheres that matter. Because what he says is that although we separate what is play from the serious, we take play so seriously with a sort of wholehearted desire to do our best, right? And so he was interested in what would happen if you brought that wholehearted desire to do our best, and that's playfulness, into the real sphere. And that's what I'm looking at also. You know, when I talk to gamers, you know, they feel this sense of becoming the best versions of themselves in games. And I think we should stop pretending that gamers are somehow different versions of themselves when they play games versus who they are in reality. You know, you are the same person. You are resilient in the face of failure. You are optimistic and curious. You will collaborate with others. You will rise to the heroic occasion. I think it's important that we start to look at that innate quality in all of us that games are awakening, and then say, hey, if that's who we are, if that's what we're capable of, can we do more of that in our lives?
Given some of the popular discourse about games, particularly the kind of dark vision of games and some popular discourse, you spent a good deal of the book early on explaining why games actually aren't the source of all evil, that they're not all about violence, addiction to gameplay, obesity, isolation. Mm. But in fact, they're designed to provide some very powerful psychological and social benefits. What exactly are some of those benefits?
Yeah. So in the first part of the book, I look at the four really powerful benefits of games. And what was really interesting to me is that I was doing my research on games at UC Berkeley, trying to figure out what do games give us that it's really hard to get in our real lives. And I came up with these four things. And then I discovered the field of positive psychology, sort of the science of well-being and satisfying, meaningful life. And it turns out they were working on their own list of things that we need to really flourish as human beings. And just this year, the father of positive psychology came up with his sort of ultimate list. These are the four things that you need to live a meaningful, happy, satisfied life. And it's the same four things that I call out in the book. So we'll say what those four things are in a minute. But for me, what's really key is that these are four things that any person would be happy and lucky to get out of real life. And we get them from games. So the games are a way of filling our lives with what we really want. So the first thing is satisfying work, just the sense that you can sit down and start a project, attack a goal, and then at the end of the day, feel like you've made progress, get the positive feedback, see where you are on your journey, and really feel like you got something done. A lot of people have jobs or are on sort of long journeys, like being in school and it feels like you'll never graduate, or writing a book and it feels like you'll never finish. And we look to games to have more satisfying work. When I was writing this book, I can't tell you how many hours I spent playing Farmville, which is, we'll be neighbors. I mean, it's like not by any means the most brilliant or exciting game, but I could go on, I could plant my flowers and garden, and I'd like be sure that when I came back 8 hours later, no matter how much I had failed to make progress in writing my book, I could come back, the plants would be grown, I would harvest them, I'd feed my puppy. So that's just one of those things, right? And we need that. It turns out, and so the other thing that I'm really interested in is that blurry line between games and reality. So in the book, I write a lot about studies that show when we get a rewarding game, it can springboard us in real life. So 70% of CEOs admit playing games at work. And when you ask them their number one reason for playing games at work, they say to feel more productive, which is super crazy when you think about it, that someone at work is going to play a game to feel more productive. But what it turns out what it does for them is it gives them this lift, this sense of success, this like Fiero moment where then they go into their next meeting or their difficult phone call or whatever they're working on, feeling that success, and it can buoy them past real obstacles, right?
And for those who don't understand games, aren't conversant in game theory or Italian, would you explain Fiero?
Yeah, Fiero is like the classic gamer emotion. Do any of you guys know what Fiero is? If you know what Fiero is, you should make the Fiero sign, although I just gave it away. Nobby Dashwell. Yeah, oh, well, good. Good for you. That's my husband. That's why he knows what the Fiero sign is. Right, so Fiero is the Italian word for pride we feel when we overcome a really difficult triumph. Or we triumph over a really difficult obstacle. And it's kind of universal emotion around the world. And we know it's universal because everybody makes the same expression. So think about like soccer players after they make a goal. It's like, rah! Or you get to the top of the mountain and you're like, rah! That's Fiero. And it's the super quintessential gamer emotion. You can film gamers playing games and then when they're like, whoosh, and it just happens all the time. And it's the most potent neurochemical high that you can have, according to what the researchers have worked out about it, that it is an incredible high combination of self-pride and self-worth and feeling of success. So we get Fiero, and then that Fiero can make us more successful in real life, which is great because it means that it's not a matter of being successful at games, but I'm really lame in real life. It's my success in games, my little Angry Birds 5 minutes, you know, before I come up on stage and give a talk and hopefully feel really successful so that it helps me do a good job, you know. That was only one. Should I more quickly mention the other three?
Absolutely.
Real quick? Yeah. So the second one is the, I call it urgent optimism, which is the belief that there's something important that needs to be done, and I am the person to do it, that I have a reasonable chance with my core strengths and abilities of succeeding. And I write a lot in the book about the science of optimism and how people who are more optimistic are more successful. When you take away all the different factors like, income, intelligence, education, gender, height, I mean, anything that could influence success, take that all away, and optimism is a really crucial factor to success. But it's important that you only be optimistic in situations where your skills are matched to the challenge, right? So when we play games, we're constantly assessing, you know, am I capable of this, particularly in game worlds where we have to collaborate and different people take on different roles. So we're drawn to the things that we might be better at. Like, I'm a healer in World of Warcraft, and that's because that's something that I'm good at, so I'm drawn to that role. So anyway, the sense of optimism is really also pervasive, that if you can build up this internal reservoir of optimism, that it can help you find goals in real life that you're suited for, help you understand your strengths better. The third is building up better social connectivity. I won't go into all the research, but when we play a game with somebody, we like them better. We trust them more, and we feel connected to them. Even if they beat us, even if they trash talk us. In fact, there's great research from UC Berkeley that shows that trash talking is actually conducive to building a stronger friendship, because it lets somebody show their superiority to us, and that makes us vulnerable, and then they see that we trust them, and they feel better because they feel better about themselves, so they like us more because we like people that we feel better than. And then we like them more because they like us, because we also like people who like us. So it's this like virtuous cycle of building up a relationship, even when somebody is totally beating you and trash talking you, which is great. So I'm really excited about social gaming, because it's this opportunity for us to connect in real life with friends and family and stay that sort of trusting, bonded. The last is the sense of epic meaning, or the sort of heroic purpose of wanting to serve something bigger than ourselves, particularly in game communities that are massively multiplayer, or that have these online communities that are building wikis and talking about the game world online, or have these sweeping mythologies that kind of give you goosebumps, like awe and wonder. We know that when we feel awe and wonder, we feel called to serve a higher cause. And there's a really gray area right now in gaming where I don't think it's not necessarily leading into real world effects yet. You know, we feel all in wonder when we go into Halo, and it's this like incredible universe that hundreds of people have worked on for years to create. It's like a cathedral of gaming, and we get the goosebumps. I'm really interested in how feeling humbled by these games could be a driver for us to be more cooperative, to be more pro-social.
And I want to get you a chance to talk about some of your own games that you've been involved in designing. Real briefly, one of the really interesting points you make is that we should actually, if we're trying to understand collaboration in games, in social games, we should actually kind of think about Wikipedia as a massively multiplayer online game. In what ways, briefly, should we think about Wikipedia as a game?
Yeah, well, so it's interesting. So this was not my idea. So actually, a lot of the most engaged Wikipedians have started a special project on Wikipedia that you can look up if you're interested. It's called Why Wikipedia is an MMO, and they've outlined, hundreds of them, this perfect little description of Wikipedia as an MMO, and every article is a dungeon, and you go on these quests, and you battle the vandalism, and you try and explore these dark regions that aren't known yet, so you know the map that's not known, you have to fill it out with the articles, and they look at it as a game. And they wrote this article to try and explain why they were spending so many hours working for free on this incredibly collaborative task. And I think it's really interesting that their best framework for understanding why you would volunteer to do this incredible, challenging project together their best metaphor for that is a game. It speaks to how central volunteering and challenge and obstacle and collaboration is to games, more so than we would think about normally, thanks to the media, thinking about games is just being about violence and competition and status and leaderboards. But really, it's about these incredible obstacles that we can face together.
And just a reminder that people should be writing down questions, because in about 5-10 minutes, we're going to turn to your questions, and I'll be asking those. I want to ask you to talk about some of your games that you've designed. What did you aim to accomplish in the world with these games? Why don't we start with a simple game like Bounce?
Sure. Yeah, so I should say there are two kind of different categories of games that I've been working on. One is games designed to just improve our quality of life. Like, when I wake up in the morning, do I feel good about my day? Do I feel like I have something important to do or someone I want to see and connect with? So one of the games that I did in this category was called Bounce. I actually did it while I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley. We were contacted by a group that was doing research on quality of life for seniors, and particularly seniors who are living in retirement centers or living alone, and the sense that they were excluded from society at large. And the thing that they missed most was interaction with younger people. So we wanted to think of a game that would inspire interaction across the generations, but knowing that it's really hard to, like, go visit a senior center and be social with seniors you don't know. It can even be hard to call your own grandparent. When I was playtesting this, I was playtesting it with my grandparents and my husband's grandparents. And you call them up, and it's like, what do we talk about? I don't know. I mean, there's a social awkwardness. It's why we don't call our grandparents more when we totally should. So we invented this game, a conversation game. It's a 10-minute conversation game. One player has to be online, so we found typically it was the younger player. The countdown clock starts, you get 10 questions, and you have to think of an answer that's true for both you and the person you're talking to. And you want to think of the most unusual answer you can. So, for example, what's a body of water you've both went swimming in? Or what's a book you've recommended to a friend? You know, some kind of life story that you're looking for in common with somebody else. And so it just sparks conversations. You know, if you and I were trying to do it, you know, we would try and think, like, we want to think of something really unusual. Have you ever been swimming, you know, outside of California State or outside of the country? You know, we start to tell stories, right? And so we tested this with the senior center in San Jose, actually. And in fact, we told the seniors that we had a game we wanted them to play. They were like, oh, no, don't want to do it, blah, blah, blah. And then we were like, we're going to sit by phone, and it's going to ring, and someone's going to ask you 10 questions about your life. And you want to see how many of these answers you can get in 10 minutes. They're like, oh, that sounds totally good. I totally want to do that. So they played, and it was great. And we had young people calling in and partnering up with them. The game's online, so you can play it. Since the book has come out, I've been getting emails from people saying, you know, I called my grandparents, and it was, like, cool. And anyway, so it's just a very simple game. It's a 10-minute game. But it's designed to be played with somebody in your life who is senior that maybe you'd like to connect with, but it can be awkward without a game.
And then let's talk about some of the large-scale games you've worked on as well. How about World Without Oil?
Yeah. World Without Oil was definitely a breakthrough game. So it was like the first game that took seriously the idea that ordinary people could come up with solutions to the world's toughest challenges. What we wanted to do was to see how people would react if we ran out of oil, right? So there's a common futurist scenario called peak oil, where the world stops producing oil fast enough to meet the demand. And this is particularly possible as, you know, we have rising demand for oil in developing countries and developing markets like China and India. And we didn't want to just ask people, you know, to answer questions. What do you think would be a good idea? We wanted to challenge them. We wanted them to change their real-life behaviors to really test if their assumptions were true. So we decided to run a 6-week simulation of an oil shortage. We created this really cool, mysterious narrative about, you know, what had happened, why it was happening. And you could sign up to live your real life as if the shortage were happening. So you would have to actually find a different way to work. You would have to, you know, prepare your meals differently. If you were going out on a date, you should have to plan the date in such a way that it would fit the scenario. We would ask you to do blog posts, podcasts, photos, videos, social media documenting what you were doing. And so we were able to get 1,800 gamers to commit to this six-week scenario, and they filled the internet with thousands of stories of creative ways that they were changing their lives. Everything from Fellowship Without Oil, where we had religious leaders writing sermons for real congregations about living World Without Oil. We had a group called Zoom Zoom Without Oil, which were NASCAR enthusiasts who were trying to figure out how you would have a future of racing without oil. So we document this online. But then the cool thing that happened was a year later, we actually had an oil crisis in the United States. And the real world oil prices started to match what we had forecast in the game. So we were able to watch the gamers who had gone through this already in the game and had met the survival challenge in the game feel like they totally were ready for the challenge. They had their ideas ready. They had their new habits. They got their friends and family involved. And so the motto of that game was play it before you live it. And it gives you this kind of edge. And I think what made it fun, because obviously it's like not fun to reinvent your life and use less energy. It's hard. But we made it a survival challenge. We said, can you survive? Put yourself to the test. We tapped into that sense of eustress, of it being an unnecessary obstacle.
And then as people are writing their questions and handing them around, tell us a little bit about Evoke. Is that the game you've worked on most recently?
Yeah, Evoke for the World Bank Institute. So we called this a 10-week crash course in changing the world. And by the way, you'll notice there's a theme in a lot of my games. They're kind of limited because I think that games that try to solve real-world problems or kind of get you involved in some real-world adventure, these are games that you want to have an experience of and sort of own that experience, but not play all the time. You know, it's not like a game like World of Warcraft, like go back to it every night for 2 years. You know, it's not meant to replace ordinary games by any means. You know, it's take a break, an hour a week, come play one of these real games, real world, you know, games. So Evoke was a 10-week crash course in changing the world. Our goal was to teach young people how to start their own social enterprises, how to start small local businesses that could tackle problems like hunger, poverty, climate change. And we were particularly asked to reach out to youth in sub-Saharan Africa. And what we were told was that they did not think it was possible for them as young people to help Africa overcome all of its daunting challenges. So we created a graphic novel set 10 years in the future in which the rest of the world was falling apart. Africa was actually doing pretty well, but the rest of the world, Tokyo's having food shortages, London's having floods, Rio's having power outages, and they turned to this secret network of social entrepreneurs in Africa who've spent the last 10 years working on their local companies, working on creative problems, and they become the superheroes for the rest of the world. So we invented this mythology to help change the way of thinking. And that graphic novel, you know, graphic novels, they can really tap into that sense of superhero purpose. So that's how we were able to engage the students. We actually got just under 20,000 students from over 130 countries wound up being enrolled in the course. And they collectively created more than 50 real companies, so real working enterprises now that were funded by global giving, that were matched with real mentors, and are now out in the world trying to tackle these problems, but also in a way that's economically sustainable. So, yay.
And Dave, if you want to hand over questions, I'll just ask one more of my own, and then we can move on to what people are thinking in the audience.
And by the way, if I could just add one more thing about this. You know, so the books are both about games that we play more as escapist entertainment and also these real-world games. And it's not about one or the other. It's not that we have to make all games that we make suddenly have to become serious, right? Because we know that just traditional entertainment games can help us become better versions of ourselves and it's like springboard to real life. And then the serious games, we're not saying that these are going to, you know, that it will be possible to make, you know, ending hunger or poverty as fun as it is to, you know, play Rock Band. That's not the idea. The idea is we need all hands on deck for the next century with how many incredibly urgent problems we face as a planet. And nobody has the skills and the heart to take on the task of saving the world more than gamers. So we're just looking for ways to funnel some of that incredible passion and ability to real problems. It's not going to make it, you know, easy, but it'll make it hopefully more engaging and more realistic for people to actually do something that matters.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the only question that I'm left with is, since everything has its limits, what are some of the limits of what can be addressed or accomplished through game design principles? Are there certain human experiences or social or political problems that are incapable or just very hard to address in a game? Maybe because they don't involve goal-directed activity, or they aren't governed by clear rules, or our participation in them is not voluntary.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely what we're seeing is it's easier to make games that drive behavior when you have a clear goal or you have a clear path to success. So Nike Plus is a great example. Like, Nike Plus is a game. It turns your running into a game, and you know what the goals are. You know, faster time, more miles, faster than my friends. And it's very structured. And by creating game-like feedback in this online system where you're leveling up your little running avatar, it can drive the best performance in you. That's a lot easier than situations where we don't necessarily even know what our goals should be. We haven't decided on that as humanity yet. Or we don't know, maybe we know our goal is world peace, but we don't have any idea how to achieve it, right? It's like a wicked problem that we're just going to have to start solving it before we even know what the solution is, right? Those are harder to turn into a game. But I still think that, you know, there's a difference between making everything a game and just making things gameful, where we can just tap into our gamer spirit. You know, if just playing games for 20 hours a week helps you tap into that sense of heroic purpose and incredible resilience in the face of tough problems, and then you go towards real-life goals with that same gameful spirit, I think that in a lot of situations could be enough. So not just turning everything into a game, but just saying these games are showing us something about ourselves that we can bring to reality.
Let me ask, find out what some people are wondering about out in the audience. How do you come up with ideas for games that you're going to make?
Yeah. this is great. I love questions that I have, like, no idea what they're going to be, and then I just start saying things that are true, and then I worry later about should I have said that. When I want to make games, I usually walk around feeling like something is wrong or broken, which is why the book is called Reality is Broken. You know, and just looking for something that would bring me more happiness or bring me better engagement. So one of my favorite games that I've ever made is, like, completely ridiculous. I was working on this book and totally frustrated and lonely because you're at home all the time. And I was like, what would make me happy now? I should be dancing more. I just sort of hit on dancing, but I'm really shy and I don't dance around with other people. And so I'm like, I need to make a game that will get me dancing every day and get my friends dancing with me, even people who don't live in the same state as me. I want to dance with them every day. So I invented this game called Top Secret Dance Off, which was loosely modeled after World of Warcraft, except you are your avatar and you have your avatar is a disguise that you make up. And you go on these dancing quests, like dance without moving your feet or dance upside down or dance on a crosswalk. And it was this, like, super addictive game where you powered up in things like exuberance or coordination or beauty or courage. And I played it for a couple months with about 500 friends, and it made me happy. So a lot of times when I, you know, the other interesting example for the game that I did for the Olympics, you know, I was like, the Olympics are completely broken because they're supposed to bring the world together through play, but nobody plays except for a very rarefied elite. And it's not global. We sit at home alone in front of our TVs. I don't interact with people from around the world. It's totally not what the promise of the Olympics is. So we invented a game that, first of all, was truly global. It was played in simultaneously in 8 different languages, and the players had to figure out how to translate what was going on. And we invented a sport that we said had been banned by the ancient Greeks, so no one knew how to play it, which meant you could be the best in the world and be an Olympic champion because nobody else knows how to play it. So you have a reasonable shot. And we actually were able to teach people to play it in the real world, training for 6 months before the Olympics and hold a gold medal championship in Beijing. So that's how I think about games. Like, what's broken? How can we fix it? Yeah.
And you got an idea for one of your games by almost breaking your head?
Oh, yeah. In 2009, also while I was writing the book, which by this makes it seem like writing the book was like the worst, hardest thing I ever did, which it might be, turn out to be. I hit my head and I had a concussion, which didn't heal properly. I wasn't able to read or write for about a month. And that was really bad because I was on sabbatical from work and I was supposed to be writing my book. And I had a couple months to finish it and get back to work. And I couldn't work on the book, and I couldn't work at all. For those of you who've had tough concussions, you might know that it tends to make you really anxious or depressed. It's your brain's way of work trying to heal itself. But if you don't overcome those feelings, it can actually slow down the recovery process. My doctor was like, you can't be depressed and anxious all the time. You won't heal. So I was in the middle of writing this book about how games, you know, make us optimistic and make us, you know, socially connected. And I was so depressed and pessimistic and lonely. I thought I could probably only survive this if I made it into a game. So you can actually go online and watch really funny YouTube videos of me the day that I decided to do this, where I'm like still super concussed and I'm like can't think of the words that I'm supposed to be saying, but I'm like, I'm going to make this game, and here's how it'll work. And I just start talking about this design. But anyway, wound up playing it. I credit it with saving my life. We've been testing it with other people. And we're actually about to go into clinical trials with Ohio State University. And we're developing it as a game that people will be able to download for their iPads or phones or play online. So we want other people to be able to have. It's called Super Better. I don't know if I mentioned that. And I was Jane the Concussion Slayer. I didn't really explain how the game works. We read about it in the book.
But you assigned key roles, gameplay roles, to each of your friends and family, right?
Yeah.
And they were there to provide the key support that you would need. If you were a doctor, you would say, you need somebody to do this for you, right?
Exactly, yeah. Like, are there any Buffy the Vampire Slayer fans in here? Right, so, like, I asked my sister to be my watcher, and she had to call me every day and give me a duty, like a task that I had to fulfill, and she would call me and see how I did. And that was important to me because I had a hard time saying, I have a concussion, I'm lying in bed, I can't do anything, I can't go out, I'm really lonely, I'm really bored, please call me every single day. But I was able to say, you're my watcher. Your mission is to call me every single day. And then she would do it, you know. My husband was Willow, the kind of geeky best friend who could do my email for me and look up scientific articles explaining concussions. And I made my friends Natalie and Ramel Xander, who's the comic relief character, and their job was to just come over once a week and make me laugh, which is, like, cool because taking care of a friend who's sick or injured can be really hard. Like, you want to help, but you don't know how, or it feels awkward. You know how it is. You go to visit someone, you're like, what can I do? They're, like, really sick. It's not the version of them I'm used to seeing. So this game gave people a way to be there for me in a way that they didn't have to feel awkward or vague about, and it gave me a way to enlist friends and family and you know, talk about how hard it was, but really get the most out of everyone in my social network.
So I'm thinking that the ability to turn a concussion into a Buffy the Vampire Slayer game has got to have something to do with your Jesuit education at Fordham. How did that?
I watched it. You know, Buffy started while I was at Fordham, so I remember watching it in the dorms. The idea of Jesuit education. Obviously something I was really strongly influenced by was this idea of being of service, you know. So every game that I make is in service of something, some good that I'm trying to bring to completion in other people or in the world, you know. So for me that is something that I'm always thinking about. You know, I'm not thinking about necessarily entertainment. I'm thinking about trying to entertain while being of service.
In contrast, why are so many of the most popular games not like yours? Why are they shoot-em-ups?
Sure.
Why do they involve violence? And does that transfer at all to real life?
Yeah, okay. So good news, at least for me this is good news. top 20 video games of the year, this year, last year, the year before that, you go back at least 5 years, only a few games in the top 20 games will be graphically violent games. You'll see sports games, you'll see action games, you'll see puzzle games, you've got the Super Mario games, you've got the dance games, you've got... So, you know, there are over 100 million people playing Cityville now on Facebook, right? So there is, best-selling Xbox Kinect. Those are much more sort of social, less violent games. So for me, it's good news that there is, broadly speaking, fewer popular violent games with every passing year. And that's not to say I'm not a fan of games that are violent. I'm a fan of Halo. I'm a super fan of Left 4 Dead. I will point out, in both of these games, you're killing aliens and zombies and not other people, which to me somehow feels better. That's just me. I don't like to shoot people, so I don't play Call of Duty or anything. But zombies and aliens is, like, totally fine. But what we're seeing in those games is an increasing emphasis on teamwork or cooperation, right? So, like, people play Left 4 Dead because it's such an intensely cooperative experience. You depend on your fellow players more than any other game, right? Or the sense of teamwork that when you're playing, you know, a multiplayer match and you're all banding together. Violence is part of our culture, it's part of our media, it's part of what makes games feel high stakes, you know? If it were totally abstracted into just abstract capture the flag, we wouldn't have that charged up narrative. There's pros and cons, but there's some really interesting research to look at around violent games that I think it's worth mentioning. There's a lot of research that shows that people who play violent games are able to control their nightmares. So when they start to have a nightmare, they can become a first-person player in the nightmare and stop it and turn it not into a nightmare, which is, like, a pretty cool superpower to have, sort of dream master. And then you get that by playing violent games, so that they actually really recommend it to people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. If there's a violent component, that playing violent games can help you overcome post-traumatic stress disorder. Also studies that show that the majority of teens who play violent games and ask them why they're doing it and what they're getting out of it, they talk about using it strategically to vent, and that it seems to prevent them from really seriously considering violence in the real world. There's not any study yet to date that links playing violent games with taking real world aggressive violent action. And the last point, so video games started becoming super popular in 1990s, super violent and super popular, and violent crime has gone down dramatically since the early 1990s, particularly youth crime rates. So we have, 97% of boys under 18 report playing video games, most of them violent, and youth crime rates are down dramatically. So we don't think there's a link, which is also good news.
Another critical question from another standpoint. To what extent are the four kinds of psychological rewards that gamers receive actually obstacles to real-world engagement?
Yeah.
By offering more immediate, accessible, and lower-risk paths to these feelings of satisfaction, success, sociality, and wonder, why seek these in the real world where they're much harder to come by when you can simply get them from a game?
Yeah, that's a great question. Who asked that? Would somebody mind? Can I just... Yeah, super good question, right? So it's a balance. Right now it looks like if you spend 21 hours a week or fewer playing games, that these become more of a springboard to real life. If you get up to 28 hours or more a week, that it turns into this sort of self-driving cycle where you seek the rewards in games, that it becomes an obstacle. There's a really good study that came out last week that maybe might have even prompted your question. I'm not sure. Sort of a two-year study looking at 3,000 students, young people, and how their gaming was related to things like social anxiety, school performance, depression. I think it's pretty great. There are a number of studies. In fact, I have a little thing in the Wall Street Journal going up tomorrow talking about a bunch of these studies that basically show 21 hours a week or less, and it becomes something that trickles over into real life. 28 hours or more, it becomes a block to real life. And this is not really widely known yet. You know, these studies are all disparate. One of the studies was done by the U.S. Army, and it wasn't really publicized. So I think that's an important number to keep in mind. And then once the games, we're seeing more and more games that connect to real life. So, like, if you're playing social games, you're playing them with real-life friends and family, those hours are more helpful to your real life than, say, playing a game by yourself alone. Games that are physical, right, can have lasting impact on your health and your likelihood to be physically active, right? So there are lots of different things that make me also optimistic that the hours we spend gaming are, you know, connecting to real-life friends and family, real-life activity better, which is good to look for, too. But there's definitely too much of a good thing. And I think we need to start learning how to recognize, you know. But that said, if you're going through a really dark period, I'm not against using games as a crutch. You know a lot of people who go through very dark periods of their lives, and games get them through it. So it's kind of, you know, if you have to escape reality for 2 months, you know.
There are worse ways.
There are lots of worse ways.
A few more of these kind of critical questions here. What are the greatest fears, what are your greatest fears about what gaming can do? Mm. Is it sinister forces using them to steal personal data? Is it creating narratives that are divorced from the world as it is?
Yeah.
Let's start with the question about personal data. You talk about Foursquare in your book. Positive community-building aspects of Foursquare. This is the website and service that allows you to kind of log in from anywhere you might be physically, let your friends know I'm there, and if you're the person who's logged in more than anybody else from that particular place, you get declared the mayor of that place. And
yeah.
So people kind of compete to become known as the mayor of, I don't know, the St. Clair room at Santa Clara University. So what about some of the positive community-building aspects of that site? What about the creepy privacy-stealing?
Yeah, that's actually not even what I think is the creepiest. But Foursquare is a great example of sort of light side, dark side. What I like about Foursquare, first of all, you know, when it was founded, the idea at the heart of it was get out of your house and have a real adventure, right? The sort of the basis for Foursquare is that you're unlocking achievements. I don't know if any of you guys have seen the T-shirt. It's an Xbox Live achievement. It says, achievement unlocked, left the house. And the sort of, you know, sense that, like, it can be really hard to get out and do something. I'm kind of a homebody, and I get really, when I'm out on, you know, a weekend, I'm like, hey, Kiyash, we left the house. Like, we're awesome. So there's an idea behind Foursquare that you should get out, have your life adventures, and do it in a way that makes it more likely that your friends will show up at the same place at the same time. So their social adventures is really good. And it tapped into things that people were motivated by, like achievements and like sort of being able to have an epic win condition. Becoming mayor is like an epic win. I'm not mayor anywhere right now. I've been totally beaten by people more dedicated than I am. But it's still, you know, I think about winning back our dog park. And that would be good for my life. If I were mayor of my dog park, my dog would be super duper happy. But the dark side of Foursquare, you know, is it does kind of represent potential exploitation of game mechanics and gamers. The success of Foursquare has inspired a lot of companies to think about gamifying whatever they do so that they can, you know, sell you more stuff or get you to spend more time, you know, looking at their ads or in their stores. And you want to get, I mean, I was just at this event where somebody was explaining that they had a gamification feature where you got points if you showed up at the store, and you got more points if you walked to the back of the store, so you had to walk by all the stuff. And it means, like, the game, I'm not really sure how that's a game. It's, like, very cynical, you know, that gamers will do anything for points and to be on a leaderboard, which I'm not too worried because I don't think gamers will do anything for points or to be on a leaderboard. I think there has to be a central activity that's meaningful. But I do worry about a bunch of cynical companies. I mean, there could be non-profit cynical, you know, efforts, too, that just try to exploit game mechanics without actually tapping into that sense that games are supposed to bring out the best in us. So that's kind of scary. Yeah, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope that gamers are like much more using their sort of critical sensibilities to say that's not a game and I don't want to play it.
Any other concerns about something that would be unethical to put into a game or some unethical game dynamic that that you're concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, increasingly, I'm really more in favor of games that are cooperative, and that's you know, I would like to see more games putting the sort of cooperative mechanics in there in ways that are intense and in situations that feel fraught with peril. Like, I worry a lot about these games being like Pollyanna or like Mr. Nice Guy, but really it's in the toughest situations when we have to cooperate. So I think there's a risk of, you know, cooperative games not being developed as with the sort of sense of adrenaline and adventure. That's a fear I have. It's not a fear of people doing horrible things. It's just a fear of neglect, you know? So.
Or that they might be boring or simpy?
They're not boring. And it turns out, if you ask gamers of multiplayer games right now, on average, they prefer co-op to competitive 3-to-1. But it's usually cooperative. But it's usually in really crazy games like Call of Duty or Left 4 Dead, where it's intense. It's not like, you know, let's pass marshmallows around a fire for an hour. You know, which is the nicest thing I could think of off the top of my head. Because actually, I would really enjoy passing marshmallows around a fire. So that's a terrible example.
What are some good games for someone to get started with, especially if they're an older person who has never really played many games?
Okay. Angry Birds is good because you can play it on pretty much any platform, so that's good. It only takes a few minutes, which is, I like Angry Birds because it gives you a chance to, like, get that experience of failing 80% of the time. That's one of the quintessential gamer realities that this great researcher, Nicole Lazzaro, has shown that gamers spend about 80% of their time failing. Angry Birds is a great example of that, you know, that you're going to be failing a lot. And that's cool, and you're going to still try, and you're going to learn, and you're going to make it. If you were just looking for a quick sense of what that sort of gamer feeling is, Angry Birds is a really good example. There's also, if you're thinking about games that are tied to real-world challenges, there's a great new game that I'm excited about called Eterna. It's like Eternal without the L. And the last three letters, RNA, stand for, like, actual RNA, ribonucleic acid. And you're manipulating, in a 3D virtual environment, RNA, sort of designing strands. And then the scientists who created the game at Stanford University are testing your designed RNA against different algorithms that they know would be more or less likely to help treat diseases like cancer. And then they're going to take the top-scoring virtual designed RNA and synthesize it in the lab, and really, so they call it, you know, played by humans, scored by nature. And it's this great game. You can just dive in online. You don't need to know anything about biochemistry to be able to play it, but you have this connection to real science and real world changing goals. And so that's something you can go online and play for free today. And it's a good way to dive in.
How can gaming help people change a bureaucratic organization with authoritarian administration from below? I should note that this is written on a page torn out of James G's What Video Games Have to Teach Us About Learning and Literacy.
Is it really? That's a cool book.
Souvenir,
I like
for
that.
You.
You're reading some good stuff. A bureaucratic organization with authoritarian administration from below.
We like to ask simple questions.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Just go ahead and knock this one right out of the park.
My first thing I would say, this is only a little bit of a cop-out, but you could read Cory Doctorow's book, Little Brother, if you hadn't, which is about gamers toppling an authoritative government. And he uses a lot of gamer tropes, including live-action gaming and online gaming, that I will not be able to recount in all of their full glory. But Little Brother is a good reference point there. You know, we have something at the Institute for the Future that's it's a tool designed to help organizations or communities come up with radically creative new ways of thinking about what they're doing. It's called a foresight engine, and it's kind of like the Twitter of future forecasting, but you also are trying to level up in your different forecasting powers. Your sort of dark imagination, which is the ability to imagine really bad consequences to a new way of doing things, or your positive imagination, which imagines, you know, positive outcomes to a new way of doing things. And we've run this with lots of different organizations where they're able to collect more than 4,000 ideas within 24 hours just from members within. And so it's a good way to provoke crazy ideas and to sort of show collective strength behind crazy ideas. So that's something also that's online that you can play with. It's called the Foresight Engine.
So unfortunately, we have time for only one more question. I'm going to use my prerogative to ask, how did the game get you and your husband to compete over who would clean the bathroom?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I'm glad you asked about this, because this is a apparently my book is very controversial, I have to say. I've been reading lots of things online that suggest it's controversial. And this is one of the games that apparently is controversial, which I won't understand for the life of me, because it was super awesome. It got my husband to clean our whole apartment on a fairly regular basis, which I consider to be, I know, wow, right?
College students take note.
How could that be anything other than the best thing ever? So there's this cool platform called Chore Wars. It was designed as, they call it a chore management system. But you can actually use it for whatever you want. So I have, like, friends who run a blog, and they use the writers are, you know, the chores are writing different articles or conducting interviews or weeding out the bad comments, you know. You can use it for anything you want. You design whatever has to be done in your little group. And it could be household chores, like cleaning the toilet or doing the dishes or taking out the trash. And then you assign XP based on how hard it is and how hated it is, so that people who do it will actually get more XP and then have a higher probability of finding loot if they do it.
So, like, if I clean the toilet, I get 100 points, or I find some loot.
Yeah, like 50-50 chance of getting some loot. And it's all stackable, and you find out at the end of the week who's got the most loot, who's got the XP points. And what they recommend is using it for actual, then, to trade for real-world favors, like, you know, movie we get to rent, or what, you know, where we should go for dinner, or whatever other things you might think about asking other people for using your virtual goods. And we don't play it all the time, but we played it when we moved into our new apartment, and we're like, it's a big apartment, we don't know what to do. So it was a big mess all the time. So we played it for a couple weeks, and it was funny. And we wound up doing some funny things, like hiding the toilet brush so that the other person couldn't do it, or waking up really early in the morning so that we could sneak in a little cleaning. I would say we should live our whole lives this way. But it's a fun way to kind of, you know, if you have a new roommate or something, it can be kind of a fun way to...
Or teenagers.
Teenagers. Well, I wrote about this. I get emails all the time now from people saying that they played it with their kids. But, you know, I also have seen some angry people online saying that they don't want to be forced to do chores, and therefore the book is very controversial. So I don't know. I'll leave that. Make up your own mind.
So some takeaways from this evening: you can use games to get people who wouldn't clean up their bathrooms to clean their bathrooms.
Right. I wouldn't call it the top takeaway, but that's
okay.
It's on the list.
For college students, that's
sure?
Okay,
okay,
important. You can get games to teach people to do remarkable things in large-scale numbers that they wouldn't be able to do alone. You can cultivate some very positive aspects of the human personality and sociability through games. As well as other aspects that maybe aren't. And then if we're trying to think about how to enlist a lot of people to solve some of the biggest problems in the world, we could do worse than look at them as games and think of ourselves as game designers.
Mm-hmm.
Any others that I'm missing tonight?
That was perfect.
Wow. XP for me.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Markla Center for Applied Ethics, the Center for Science, Technology, and Society, the High Tech Law Institute, and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank very much Jane McConigal, game designer and author of Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World, and Dr. Chad Raphael, Department Chair and Professor of Communication at Santa Clara University, and to all of you for joining us tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you.